Wednesday, the ACLU lodged a complaint in Detroit over the January 9th arrest of a black man who was unjustly arrested because of facial recognition technology mistakenly identified him as a suspected shoplifter. Currently in Washington, it's partly cloudy and 88. In New York, it's sunny and 84. I'm Askia Muhammad. Thank you for listening to WPFW Washington and WBAI New York.
Flash your light to watch the world burn. Everybody in the place, you know you better concern. Don't see smoke without no fire, and they can't make no sense of it all. Cause the world's on fire, world's on fire, world's on fire, man, the world's on fire. Darling, see them, there's no mercy. Whoa, the truth is eating, getting better. Whoa, we don't need none of that figure down, no. We don't need that, no, no. Get the road, we don't need figure down, no. We don't need that.
Well, happy, beautiful, wonderful summer Thursday, one and all. You are listening to your station for Jazz and Justice right here in the nation's capital. This is WPFW-FM. I'm Jamila Bay, your host for the Sex, Politics, and Religion Hour, Spar with Jamila. This is the show where we talk about a great many of the things that I know many parents tell their little ones do not raise in polite conversation. Conversation need not be boring, so that's why we talk about these topics. I am certain that if you are someone who has an email address and you are someone who has purchased anything from a retailer in the past 10 years, recently as you've opened up your email, you certainly have gotten these, I believe, rather annoying and I would argue toothless messages from retailers that go something like this. Oh, we're looking at the way Americans are protesting and coming together. We stand with all people. Come in and have your tires rotated, or something along the lines of, we stand with black folks. Use our coupon and come in and get a discount. I'm being mildly facetious. However, the truth of the matter is that a number of retailers, a number of large organizations, many of the businesses in the U.S. are reaching out to their consumers, to their fans, and they're trying to make the best of this historical moment that we're in. However, I am a skeptic. I am one who believes that their business is about profit. Their business is about making sure that people remember them and come in and spend money as our economy is doing poorly at the moment. Perhaps I'm being harsh. Perhaps I'm not being fair. And in order to challenge my own thoughts and perceptions around this moment, I wanted to bring on a guest who is a business consultant. Tracy Webb is someone who is on the West Coast and has for a very long time worked to help companies do better by recognizing that diversity is not just a buzzword. It's something that makes companies stronger, it makes company cultures better, and it's actually something that serves us all. So I want to have this conversation. I want to first of all thank Tracy Webb for being with me today. It's so great you could join me. Thank you.
No, thank you very much for having me. It is a true pleasure to be on the show, and at this critical time, I can't tell you how much gratitude that I feel to be able to give this a voice, because we are at a pivotal point in our country.
Indeed. This cycle that we're in, you know, 50 years ago, there were protests and conflicts that led to policy changes and changes in the way Americans indeed dealt with one another. 50 years on, 52 if we're counting from 1968, but who is? Mm-hmm. Today we see very similar demands, but also recognizing that, frankly, we're in a far more corporate state than we were at any other point in history, and the fact that corporations, companies, small businesses are standing in the gap where culture, politics, and business intersect. And I'm going to just be blunt. I am tired. I am cynical. Mm-hmm. I don't buy it. I don't believe it. Asterix. Ben and Jerry's came out with the most hardcore anti-white supremacy, anti-police brutality statement in the history of such statements. You know, that's a company that has been walking the walk for a very long time. But mm-hmm. when I get an email from a company saying, we stand with Black people, knowing that when I went into that same perhaps retail establishment and watched other people walk in and get service, and I stood there and got ignored until somebody finally decided to walk over and grace me with his or her presence. I feel like there's more to this moment than just platitudes. And I believe many of these emails that I've gotten, many of these commercials that I've watched are mere platitudes. So let's go to where I think the beginning of this is, which is, you know, we're in a corporate culture. Business is king. And the fact that you have Black people standing up and demanding rights that have been denied us for too long, these corporate organizations, these corporate entities are finding themselves having to respond. Admittedly, there are a lot of people such as me who are going to doubt anything that anyone says. I check it out when my mother says she loves me. Mm-hmm. but how can we be fair, but how can we be, you know, unfold in this moment, recognizing that things are changing, companies and corporations have to change too? How do we start to come to the same place where we can begin the conversation?
You know, there is a saying, and I don't know if Don Lemon said it or somebody said it, you know, I've heard it recently, that Black people can be some of the most forgiving people on the planet. Well, it's time for us to stop being so forgiving. And at this point, we need to call for and value action over well-penned words. A recent graduate from business school can write most of these Black Lives Matter statements that we are receiving, you know, from these organizations. But what really matters, what really at the end of the day, where the rubber meets the road, is we need to hold them to a course of action. We need to see what they are going to do to really work on strategic organizational changes to dismantle systemic, institutional, and individual racism in their firms. The words aren't enough.
Mm-hmm. As a consumer, I recognize that I have pretty limited power in terms of holding these companies that say we stand with Black people to account. But I do want to take advantage of the power I do have. How do you suggest that we do that kind of thing? How do you suggest that we say, all right, Company X, you stand with Black people, I spend money with you. Here are my demands, or mm-hmm. here is what we want to see. How should we take advantage of this?
I disagree with the notion that as an individual or as individual consumers that we don't have power. I don't know if it was because of the way, you know, that I grew up with two parents who were in the corporate world and who set us, you know, our dinner table conversation was how do you navigate it and how do you make a difference? But we were taught to use our voice and how to use it. So a simple rule is every organization has a chairman or chairwoman, a CEO or whatever the title is. I don't care how big the organization is. When I have felt an affront, which I have as a black woman many times going into establishments or either on the telephone or via email, you contact the office of the chairman. You do not go through public relations. You do not go through investor relations. You pick up you do a little research on the internet, find out where their corporate headquarters is, and there is always a way to find that phone number. You then call the office of the chairman. If the company's big enough, they will have 5 or 6 executive assistants that do nothing but field these calls, and you make noise. It is very empowering, and you get results. Now, that's when you're dealing with an individual approach, which happens to, you know, as a colleague of mine, Grace Carroll, calls it mundane extreme environmental racism or environmental stress, MEIS. You know, we deal with this every day. So that's an individual action, but it's very powerful. The second thing is that we have to use the press. We have to use the press to amplify our voices and to come together, including social media, to demand changes in these organizations and to call out the hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm. I'm taking notes because I have not done that.
It works.
I imagine that it must. I imagine that it does. You know, as a member of the media, I'm watching a reckoning happening in newsrooms across the country. Just today, there was a story about how the employees at the LA Times have pretty much, you know, stormed the top offices and said, we've watched the past 118 hires come in here, and a minute percentage of them are people of color. You don't hire any black people to be your editors. You don't hire any Latinas to be your editors. You have an Asian editor. We demand that change happen here. The way we tell stories in Los Angeles is skewed because you don't have the people in the community of the community telling the stories of the community. Now, those are conversations that have happened in newsrooms here in Washington, D.C. as well. The Washington Post has just announced a dozen newsroom positions that go exclusively to the reporting on race in America. But as somebody who comes from news organizations, and I am part of the media, I recognize that for years and years and years, being able to turn to the media as a community member is something that is limited. Mm-hmm. Social media has managed to change that a bit, but being able to say, hey, our stories matter. Hey, our experiences matter. And the idea of objectivity that you've been trying to put forth isn't necessarily so when you don't have people who have lived and experienced trying to tell the stories of those people. Mm-hmm. I recognize that the specific journalist argument about this moment is a larger conversation, but as we look at the fact that the people who have to tell the stories, the people who are the ones who might be able to say, hey, there's a trend here we need to look at. I want your advice on how news consumers, how people who watch the news, who consume the news, might want to recognize that there's power they have there to make sure that stories are better told and better serve their communities as well. I know I'm going to throw out the word ombudsman and let you take it from there.
there we are.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, that is all part of the same approach, which is making noise, and it's making concerted noise. So I have personally watched stories. I live in the and work in the San Francisco Bay Area, work all over the world, but I'm based here. And I have watched a number of stories of things happening in different parts of the Bay Area where certain stations have, I will say, looked for a certain type of person to put on camera to fit a certain type, a certain stereotype, okay, when something happens. And or there was a young black woman that was killed, that was brutally attacked on our BART, which is our rapid transit system, and immediately the news station, two of the news stations started talking about, put these pictures up that they found that showed her in less than a favorable light. It was a young woman. You know, they weren't obscene or anything like that, but she was African-American, and they were portraying her in a certain way. A number of us called in and asked for the station manager and said, this will not stand. They apologized 2 days later. It is about using your voice. The human brain works in a contiguous manner. So you can't sit around and mull over it. You need to take action as proximate as soon as you can to the event happening, particularly in a news cycle, so that a reckoning can happen. But once again, it's about using your voice.
Absolutely. And I just want to say, the San Francisco Chronicle is a news organization that I'm very familiar with, doesn't do it as often as you see in small papers, but it still happens. Just today in a media watch group I'm in, on a listserv, posted a front page story of a small town paper, tiny story, front page, far left column, 21-year-old man charged with double homicide, a small, you know, 1-inch by 1-inch square photograph of a white man. You look to the center of the page where your eye is drawn above the fold, big, huge, you know, probably 4 inches square picture of a black man, clearly a mugshot. Suspect accused in string of car break-ins.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And being able to see that. Now, I'm going to quote my daddy when I say I grew up in a house where everybody was contrarian and skeptical about everything. I heard my dad's voice when I looked at this, and I heard my dad go, "Now that's a damn shame."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he'd have thrown the paper down and gone on to do something else. So instead of that response, you know, today we can go on to Twitter and tweet it. We can go on to the, you know, Facebook page, the Instagram page, the whatever page, and say, hey, this is a problem. Your editors who allowed this photograph to happen this way, to you know, a suspect accused in a string of car break-ins versus a double murderer, the threat projection just of the visual, mm-hmm. is something that we see all the time. Mm-hmm. We've started to see some progress because of folks complaining. I don't like the word complaining for this. Folks calling attention to the mm-hmm. wrong practice, mm-hmm. of using mugshots for deceased, mm-hmm. Deceased victims, as opposed to graduation photos. Mm-hmm. There's a rather sad but funny meme that says, you know, papers be like, and it shows a very good looking blonde haired family hugged up on each other, you know, parents and the kids hugged lovingly, and probably a dog in the photo. And then the caption is, father kills entire family, doesn't spare dog, you know, right. And that's the picture right. that they run, you right. know, whereas, you know, whereas they show a mugshot to say, you know, youngest road scholar ever discovers cure for common cold, and it's got a mugshot from, you know, a young black man, mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I am of the mind that people are starting to, all people, Black folks have been seeing this since the 1940s, when the Pittsburgh Courier had a whole campaign capitalizing Negro and talking about if every time a black person is mentioned in larger media, they're going to say, John Smith, colored or Negro. Mm-hmm. We're going to say President Truman, white,
right,
to call attention to it. So black folks have gotten this for a long time. I think other ethnic groups have gotten this. White people, I would argue, are starting to get to the point where they see it. I don't know that enough people are starting to call it out, but I hope that that's the case in this moment. I hope that people are interested in, raising their voices and making a difference as we do go forward.
Mm-hmm.
I want to hear your opinion. Yes,
yeah,
please.
I want to. It was very interesting what you were saying, and I do think I absolutely agree with you. I think there are two sides to this. So one side is what we can do as individuals, and then collectively, external to these organizations. But the other side that is absolutely critical, and that we can no longer, ignore, is probably the best word, or try to accept. Is the responsibilities of these organizations to look at their own privilege and to question their own privilege, white privilege, and white male privilege in particular, and white female privilege, which feeds right into it. Mm-hmm. But to be able to say, okay, I need to look at this, or I'm going to look at this, or I'm willing to look at this, no matter how painful it may be, and start dismantling this. Because if you don't change your vision, if you don't change what you see, you're not going to change what you do, because you're not even going to be aware of it, in some ways because you choose not to be, in others because you've never had to be aware of it, and third, because society has given its imprimatur, its stamp of approval for that behavior, for that organizational behavior. It has to change from the inside.
Mm-hmm. So changing from the inside is the work that you help organizations do.
Right.
Please talk about Tracy Elizabeth Webb Associates.com, the company that you are, the work that you've been doing, because I want my listeners to know, your resume is incredible. I know what it is, but please share with my listeners why particularly you are the perfect person to be talking about this right now.
I think I'm one of the people to be talking about this, because I think we'll come back to that. But what we do is we work to facilitate authentic and meaningful dialogue that leads to tangible change. If it's not going to lead to change, then I don't think it's worth my time or the organization's money. I've been, living in this country for almost 60 years, and I'm not willing to waste my time or my breath anymore. So, as an example, we do this work in the context of strategic facilitations with boards of directors, senior teams, executive coaching at the senior level. And we also do a lot of community convening, where we lead difficult conversations that result in action. And I do this, obviously, a lot of work around diversity, equity, and inclusion. We also do it around just strategic organizational change and transition. And the way I got started, if I may, in this work, is that my mother was from Louisiana. And my grandfather hailed from Texas. Her dad came from Texas. Our family, and we were all told this from the time we could comprehend this story. My great-grandmother was an ex-slave who was brought from Mississippi to Texas by her mother. She had a common law marriage with my Irish great grandfather. They had 13 kids. Every single one of them earned a college degree. Four of them earned PhDs. When my great grandfather died, my grandmother, great grandmother, didn't have any education, went to court with my grandfather in tow and won against the state of Texas that tried to take all this land that they had amassed away from her. So we come from a history of, oh no, we're not going to take it. When my grandfather met my grandmother and they settled in where my grandfather was from, my grandmother was from Louisiana, they left Louisiana when my mother was 7 and my grandfather was 9, because the Klan ran them out because they didn't like an educated you-know-what in town in Shreveport, Louisiana. What my mother and my uncle and my father and stepfather instilled in me was this notion that you have to fight, but you have to fight in a way that's smart and where you understand the system and you understand who you're talking to. So I have spent pretty much my entire career honing this skill of listening, of really listening and trying to figure out where people are so that you can facilitate dialogue that really drives change. I have found that skill incredibly helpful now as this all of this racism is being exposed. All of the warts and scars are being exposed. So when I have gone in to do some of this work in community settings, I raise difficult questions. I raise issues that make people very uncomfortable. I have seen people get very angry. I'm not worried about that. What I'm worried about is where do we come out at the end of the day? Are we closer to some form of understanding that leads to action? So I just want to tell you one last thing. There was an incident up here recently in Northern California, in Southern Sonoma and Northern Marin, where a Black Lives, 99%, you know, well, probably 99.5% white community, beautiful town, Petaluma, and the kids, some of the young folks were putting posters up, you know, for Black Lives Matter. And there is, it's on camera, this guy is this white guy with a hoodie on and his face covered, is pushing through and tearing down these posters. I wrote the mayor, and I said, I have done this work. I will come and work with this community. I've worked with the community just south of you on similar issues. So we'll see what happens. And somebody said to me this morning, well, would you be willing to sit down with a Klan member? Because what I do is I interview, you know, key constituents first. And Jamila, I will tell you, I had to think about this. And I would. I absolutely would sit down and interview them. Now, I'd have security with me, but mm-hmm. I would absolutely sit down because I can't do this work unless I really understand the animus behind all of it. So that's what we do. That's an example.
When you have a company who has a split personality, I forgive the phraseology there, but if you have a company that says to you, Tracy, half of us get it. Half of us really think that, you know, we need to improve our culture. We need to do a better job of recognizing inequalities that exist and, you know, move forward to make a go of including more people. But, you know, we are a company that's existed for X amount of years. We haven't done it differently. There are a bunch of us in here who are entrenched and like things just the way they are. It's serving the people. It's always served. And, you know, just as many of us who get it are the ones who are saying, let's leave well enough alone. We're doing fine. It's not our job. It's mission creep. And why is it necessary? When you have folks who are in that situation, when you have companies who are experiencing that reality, how do you even get started when you know that you're going to go in and half of the people you're going to look at are brick walls?
Short answer, I don't. If the CEO, if the voice at the top is not 200% behind the effort for change, or, and we're talking about now dealing with racism, sexism, you know, all of it, but really racism, then I'm not going to do the work because it'll be lip service. It will become, we used to call this, and this is true in any change effort. If you do not have the true support from the top, the very top, it will not work. There's this notion in change management work, well, it's, you know, bottom up and top down. The reality is in order for the strategic imperatives of the organization to change, in order for the very fabric of the organization to change, it has to come from the top. Otherwise, it's like it's writing some of these, you know, worthless or as you like to call it, and I love the term toothless, corporate statements about Black Lives Matter. It's a waste of time. And I think it's dangerous to go into an organization and try to affect any change if you don't have the support from the very top, any systemic change, if you don't have the support from the very top, because in a way you're giving that organization cover to check it off on their box. Oh, well, we did it. No, you're not really doing anything.
Yeah. And we see this often. We recognize that. I want to talk about the ghetto problem. Because there are a whole lot of companies that will hire Black people, but then they're all in one department, or they're all junior employees where you don't have any kind of color at all in the decision making positions and in the kingmaker positions. And you know, a number of companies, and I would argue most of the Fortune 500 is an example of this, where Black people are employed in pockets, or they are at the complete and total they are at the complete and total behest of white people for their employment. Mm-hmm. I feel like on the one hand, if ever change is going to happen, why not now? Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I have to wonder, wow, this is by design, and it's a pretty big design. I mean, mm-hmm. is there hope of really fixing this?
I think there is, but I think this is a problem that will be solved, if you will, by what I like to call the Black Wall Street approach. You know, the approach of us building our own. Now, I'm going to say this both as entrepreneurs, meaning with inside of companies and external to companies. So being a traditional entrepreneur where you build your own business, but also inside of companies, it is very, very important that Black folk understand that the way you succeed is you learn how to, what I like to call it, navigating the murky waters of organizational politics. You have to learn how to do it. My call is for all Black coaches, and there are a lot of us out here, Black executive and Black career coaches, to reach out and to make ourselves available. I was on a call the other day where someone said, well, you know, I'm thinking about doing a consortium of Black women coaches. I'm jumping up and down. The colleague who asked me about this, I think she's brilliant. Because we need to reach out to all levels of Black folks in their organizations and help them understand how you navigate this world. Because it is it's like a labyrinth, like an English, you know, garden, maze. You have to know how to do it, and we're not taught that. But those of us who coach and who've been trained as coaches, and many of us have been executives before, know how to do it. I will tell you that the reason I learned how to do this, I was blessed. My mother was in corporate America, and my stepfather was VP of HR at Genentech when they went public. So the stories that I learned about how to do this, we need to share. And the second point is, consider developing an entrepreneurial pursuit, even on the side. I'm not saying everybody isn't cut out for it. You know, this is not an easy life sometimes. But I think it's very important that we reach out and learn how to develop something in addition, so that we're not completely dependent upon an organizational paycheck.
Mm-hmm. So I'm again taking notes. Get my side hustle on.
There you are. Break it down.
Checking that box here. Mm-hmm. You're in the Bay Area, and Silicon mm-hmm. Valley is a lot of things. One of the delicate and difficult conversations is this one. In tech, in IT, you have a whole lot of dark-skinned people who come from South Asia, and companies will blatantly say, well, you know, 34% of our, you know, 34% of our company are diverse hires. And of that 34%, 90% is from South Asia, 10% is from Nigeria. You don't have anybody who, frankly, would have been my cousin. You know, you don't have anybody that would have come from an HBCU. And a lot of these companies will very quickly shut down the conversation. We are absolutely diverse. We are, you know, a third of us weren't even born in the U.S. You know, we have people who speak 16 languages in this country. And then when you say, yeah, but not one of you has somebody who, you know, who comes from an ancestry of people who were enslaved in this country. Mm-hmm. And until you recognize that, your diversity efforts are lacking. You get a lot of pushback and a lot of argument around that. Mm-hmm. And you are, I would argue, in the bastion of where that particular conversation ain't happening enough to my liking. Mm-hmm. One of the frustrations that I have in bringing this topic up is that a lot of people very quickly say, oh, you're being xenophobic. Mm-hmm. You're being, you know, anti-immigrant. I'm not being anti-immigrant. I'm not being anti anything, but I am a person who comes from enslaved Africans in this country. Mm-hmm. And I am a person who recognizes that my people built this country, mm-hmm. and we have been cut off from the economic drivers at every single level. And even when we talk about Black Wall Street, jealous white folks came in and burned it to the ground. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when you look to the Go West young man, young person, mm-hmm. person of any age, mm-hmm. And you say, okay, Silicon Valley, they're, you know, people who literally start with nothing, mm-hmm. can make their fortune and do for themselves and create great wealth, for themselves and their families. And I don't see anybody who comes from my background, even though we might kind of look alike on a superficial level. I get very frustrated and I don't find that conversation happening writ large to my liking. Am I just being my cynic skeptic self, or can I ask you if you are seeing any work happening in that area when we're talking about diversity isn't just the number of people who weren't born in the U.S., but, you know, how many folks like me are in your place?
You know, no, you're not being overly cynical. And as a matter of fact, I think you must have somehow channeled your spirit to come with me to a lot of these pitch sessions that I've attended. I've been a teaching fellow at the NASDAQ Entrepreneurial Center in San Francisco. Do you know how many pitch sessions I've seen where there were no Black folk? I would say, and I'm talking about Black Americans, I'm saying, mm-hmm. I would probably 99.7%. If maybe 99.8%. And I remember the last one I went to, I won't say which company, it's a major, major company headquartered in Silicon Valley. I was invited to come and, you know, watch this big showcase. And I, on the break, you know, I went out and called my significant other and I said, you will not, they are touting the diversity. And guess what? The diversity was Asians and South Asians. Mm-hmm. There was not anyone, not even an African from the diaspora, but also not even anyone of Black American descent. And our ancestors built this country, yet we are excluded from the quote unquote American dream. Mm-hmm. And Silicon Valley is one of the most calcitrant places for making any change. They don't, it is amazing to me to watch, I'm going to call it what it is, white privilege on steroids. It is just, it's all about the numbers. And that's the general excuse. It's all about the numbers. And it's about the breadth of experience. This is what I hear a lot of VCs say. This is what they're saying. Well, the numbers can be manipulated. As somebody that has an MBA, that has been lucky enough to be educated at elite schools, I will tell you that those numbers can be manipulated in a pitch session, on a pitch deck, a whole bunch of different ways. I have seen companies where startups, or potential startups, that I might not have agreed to back or voted to back if I just looked at the numbers, but I've seen panels of white males jump up and down and think it's absolutely wonderful based on an idea. But we don't get that same, we're not afforded that same
enthusiasm, courtesy, support,
courtesy, enthusiasm, yeah. Right, if you will.
Yeah. One of the things, you know, just as an aside, I come from Pittsburgh. The Pulitzer Prize winning playwright August Wilson wrote all his plays about my neighborhood that I grew up in, where he grew up in before me. The play Jitney talks about the, you know, the whatever they're called where you are, gypsy cabs, hack mm-hmm. cabs, the unlicensed yep. cabs that would pick up black people and take them where they needed to go. The minute that Uber and Lyft became the things they are with, you know, the billions and venture capital they've been able to raise. To be blunt, the first thing I said is, wow, they even took jitneying from us. You know, mm-hmm. The jitney stations had a payphone. You move it to a cell phone and now it's a big thing and mm-hmm. everybody thinks it's something wonderful. I had on my show a while ago a woman who sued Google, black woman out of Atlanta, sued Google because she went to one of their they invited her to come and pitch her program, which was in a nutshell, sort of like an Uber service for health-related issues and black communities in Atlanta, getting grandma to her dialysis kind mm-hmm. of thing. Mm-hmm. And they brought her in, they talked to her, they sent her back to Atlanta, and then, you know, she found out that they had just literally lifted her code and put it into their system.
Mm-hmm.
That's being litigated.
Mm-hmm.
She gonna win. Mm-hmm. She's going to win big,
mm-hmm.
but that issue too happens where black folks even making the attempt to go to different companies to share their brilliance don't have allies.
Mm-hmm.
We're not just going to talk about the straight up theft. How anybody believes that a white man in Kentucky came up with chicken? I mean, really, for real, whatever, you know, whiskey. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The president of the country came up with whiskey. Get the mm-hmm. bleepity blank out of here. Whatever. But again, you know,
mm-hmm.
recognizing that. There is the legitimate concern of, all right, well, I can be a pioneer. I can go into these spaces that haven't had me, but my brilliance might be recognized and exploited. Like,
mm-hmm.
I mean, what kind of laser guided landmines must we dance through? And a lot of times we frequently don't know who we can reach out to and mm-hmm. get advice from or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And that's a Silicon Valley problem. We can't mm-hmm. just Google how to protect myself black in Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
Or is there something where we can, or are there places we should be thinking about looking at or, if you know how to build our own our own personal board of directors, our own think tanks
mm-hmm.
Around the work that we do as we go into these spaces that don't have us.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I think first of all, one of the things that when I worked at Xerox, I first started my corporate career at Xerox many, many moons ago, and I remember. We had been a very active black employees group, and I remember somebody said to me, I think probably may have been like the, because I was vice president, so it must have been like one of the national presidents. He said of, you know, the group of the black employees, he said, you know, people will protect and are, will help those that look like them and that they're most comfortable with. He was not at all condoning racism, but it was a reality, you know, that he was stating. So what we need to do is to make ourselves, those of us who have this experience, make ourselves available to those who need this knowledge and information. A, how to protect yourself, and B, how to get in front of the right people. And the third thing is to work with black investors. There are black investors. Now, the issue is, in Silicon Valley, I have one of my best friends is fellow Stanford alum, but she's also alumni, but she's also a Harvard MBA. And she could never get a hold. She could never get traction when she moved here from Boston. And she had a $400 million firm in Boston, venture capital firm. She could not even get a job in Silicon Valley. She ended up working with one of the small business development centers, the SBA small business development centers in the Bay Area, and became the chief of that. If one of the things we can do is go to the SBA small business development centers and see in your area and see if there are any black consultants. That is what, because you have to be very qualified to have those roles. And generally, that consulting is free or of very little cost. I don't think it costs anything, but it's
our government, our tax dollars at work. Actually.
Then and what she ended up doing is, because she couldn't get traction here, she actually started a firm in London to help underrepresented, i.e. black folk in the UK with entrepreneurial pursuits. So we are out there. We have to make ourselves known, and people need to look for us as well.
Okay, that excites me and that infuriates me. Mm-hmm. So Stanford alum, mm-hmm. Harvard MBA, mm-hmm. $400 million firm in Cambridge, Boston, mm-hmm. Can't get a job in mm-hmm. the Bay Area, starts a firm in London?
Mm-hmm. And here. Now, she's also doing work here, too. She's also doing work here too, in another area that has been very impactful. So he splits her time between the two. But I tell you that because with all that education, and as brilliant as she is, she could not get a hold here in Silicon Valley. It's ridiculous.
So. Yeah, we okay. Start side hustle, found Black Silicon Valley esque mm-hmm. thing. Okay. Mm-hmm. At this moment, okay. Mm-hmm. At this moment, the eyes of the world are upon us as mm-hmm. Black American people right now.
Mm-hmm.
We have, I would argue, some incredible traction right now. I would argue that the zeitgeist is such that the change that many of us have been calling for and working for, I would argue that the change is happening from idea to plan. What, in your experience, gives you hope, gives you, dare I even say, any kind of certainty that this is not just a blip of a moment that will be a chapter in a history book a few years down the road?
I think there's a couple of elements. I am very hopeful, and the deeply felt genesis of my hope comes from anger. I believe I have never seen such collective anger with the situation in this country. I think that anger is being channeled into multifaceted action. And I think that is going to be the lever for change. So you have, you know, I never thought I'd say this because I consider myself eternally young, you know, but I'm almost 60. I see the young folk mad as heck, but doing something about it and protesting in mass in ways that are being recognized all over the world. I see people that are in a position that have the experience to help guide, I don't want to say guide the young people because that sounds very arrogant, but help maybe provide advice where needed, okay? And experience where needed. We're there. We're all standing united. I also see that white folk are shook up. They are truly shook up. Now, they should have been shook up 400 years ago, but I see a true sense of, oh my gosh, what is happening here? Now, the way that I think we catalyze this into true change is we don't let up from every single front. And if it means boycott some of these brands that don't, that sent out these well-penned, and I call them well-engineered missives about Black Lives Matter, and they don't follow through, then we make noise and we boycott, because Black America has tremendous dollar power. I think the other thing we have to do that is probably, this is probably, if not the, one of the most critical elections of our presidential elections and senatorial and congressional elections of our time. We have to make sure we get out and get that vote out and protect voting rights, because we're at a pivotal point. And I think the energy is coalescing to this lever of change. I also think the international pressure is building, and the disgust, you know, after the lid has been blown off about the cauldron that is America's race, you know, racist culture. I think the lid has been blown off. I have hope.
Hope. I am happy to hear that. I believe, you know, we laughed about their, I still laugh about their avocado toast, but these millennials.
You don't like avocado toast? It's delicious.
I need something more. See, I'm somebody that likes my grits and my fish and my biscuit for breakfast. I need chips with my guacamole. Or you put some avocado slices on a sandwich with some turkey for me. Anyhow, I just, avocado toast just seems like a wasted opportunity to get me some protein. But they have this from the younger women in the workplace who have brought about the Me Too movement, mm-hmm. to our young folks in the streets knocking over monuments. Mm-hmm. Don't knock over the abolitionist monuments. Those we can keep up, but whatever. Well, yeah, we know the momentum is with you, mm-hmm. but the momentum is with them, and they're going to continue this. And the hope that you know, perhaps my preteen might grow up in a world where he has every advantage and every opportunity that any other kid born here in the U.S. has, mm-hmm. And indeed around the world. Tracy, I want to give you the last word. Tell my listeners how they can find you at TracyElizabethWebbAssociates.com, mm-hmm. and how they can find you elsewhere.
And the Tracy is spelled with an E. So they can find, you can email me, you can contact me there. You can email me at Tracy, TracyEyewebb, TracyEweb@gmail.com. And those are the two best ways, and I will respond. And any way that I can help, I will. If I can network you to, if I can't provide what you need, I will do whatever I can to exercise my network to make sure that you get what you need. But we have to help each other. And, you know, if companies and organizations, I mean, I work with city councils, school districts, Fortune 100 companies. If you're interested in really making a change and really having that dialogue and you're willing to really step into it, then I'm here for you. If you're not, I keep your money.
Don't fake the funk. I want to thank you so much for this conversation, which is the first of, I think, many that have to happen. And I just want to shout out all of my media brethren in newsrooms and, you know, via email, because they're freelancers now, who are saying the way we tell these stories has to reflect more about the people who are actually living these realities. So it's all the same. I want to thank you, Tracy Webb. I want to thank you, listeners, for being with me every Thursday. I'm Jamila, and we will do it again in 1 week. Please wash your hands, wear your mask, keep each other safe.
Don't see smoke without no fire, and they can't make no sense of it all, 'cause the world's on fire, world's on fire, world's on fire, man, the world's on fire. Darling, see them, there's no mercy.
WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Askia Muhammad. Here are some headlines. The Supreme Court ruled today for the Trump administration in a key immigration case, determining that a federal law limiting an asylum applicant's ability to appeal a determination that he lacked a credible fear of persecution from his home country does not violate the Constitution. The ruling means the administration can deport some people seeking asylum without allowing them to make their case to a federal judge. The 7-2 ruling applies to those who fail their initial asylum screenings, making them eligible for quick deportation. Texas Governor Greg Abbott announced today that his state would pause its reopening while it struggles to contain a surge in novel coronavirus infections. Abbott issued an executive order to suspend elective surgeries at hospitals in 4 counties to ensure there would be room for COVID-19 patients. In New York, coronavirus hospitalizations dipped just below 1,000 for the first time since March 18th, Governor Andrew Cuomo said. 2 states, Alabama and Nevada, have reported new single-day case highs, and 4, Arizona, California, Florida, and Nevada, reached 7-day rolling average highs. But it does not appear, according to early reported data, that the U.S. total would eclipse Wednesday's record high of 38,173 cases. New York City police have arrested an officer after he was seen on video appearing to use an illegal chokehold to subdue a black man Sunday in Queens. The incident happened Sunday morning on the Rockaway Beach boardwalk. Video released by police showed an officer using an apparent chokehold on a suspect identified as 35-year-old Ricky Bellevue, days after the city council made such maneuvers by police illegal. A grand jury yesterday indicted 3 white men over the February shooting and death of unarmed black man Ahmaud Arbery while he was out jogging. Travis McMichael, his son Greg McMichael, and William Bryan were indicted at Glenn County Courthouse in Georgia on charges including malice murder, felony murder, aggravated assault, and false imprisonment. The Boston City Council voted unanimously on Wednesday to ban police and other city agencies from using facial surveillance technology. If Mayor Marty Walsh approves the vote, Boston will join 5 other communities in the state and become one of the largest cities to do so. The technology is widely considered inaccurate for non-whites. On Wednesday, the ACLU lodged a complaint in Detroit over the January 9th arrest of a black man who says he was unjustly arrested because facial recognition technology mistakenly identified him as a suspected shoplifter. The Democratic National Committee announced that it's scaling back its convention scheduled in late August. The convention was originally planned to be held at a professional basketball arena in Milwaukee. The DNC said that the convention will be held in a much smaller site in downtown Milwaukee and will be an almost entirely virtual event using live broadcasts and online streaming. Plans are for presumptive nominee Joe Biden to be on site at the end of the 4 days to deliver his acceptance speech. Israel is facing increasing international condemnation over its plan to annex parts of the occupied West Bank. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on Israel to abandon its plan.
If implemented, annexation would constitute the most serious violation of international law, grievously harm the prospect of a two-state solution, and undercut the possibilities of a renewal of negotiations. I call on the Israeli government to abandon its annexation plans.
Meanwhile, seven European nations have issued a joint statement saying annexation would violate international law and weaken efforts to advance regional peace. Belgium, Britain, Estonia, France, Germany, Ireland, and Norway